You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN 91.9 FM. I'm Skylar Butenchen. It's Wednesday, October 15th. In today's news, wildfire smoke could affect the harvest in one of Washington's largest apple-growing regions. And about 400,000 Washington State residents could lose their health coverage if federal policy changes hold. Those and other stories coming up next. You're listening to KMUN. Two homemade bombs have been found on the North Coast within the last month, and now Oregon State Police are looking for a possible connection between the two. On September 16th, a suspicious backpack was first discovered by a mother and her two-year-old son at a Sunset Beach restroom in Clatsop County. A homemade explosive device in the backpack was rendered safe by bomb technicians, and no injuries were associated with that incident. Then just last Sunday, October 12th, a community member in Chinook reported finding a homemade explosive device to the Pacific County Sheriff's Office. This time, the bomb was found on a roadway shoulder off of the 100 block of Chinook Valley Road. With support from the Washington State Patrol Bomb Squad, the device was safely removed. Oregon State Police says they are still in an ongoing investigation regarding the Sunset Beach backpack bomb incident with federal assistance. The Pacific County Sheriff's Office says there are a few leads on the Chinook Valley Road bomb. Any suspicious objects can always be reported to local law enforcement by calling 911. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian, online at dailyastorian.com. If you happen to be on the Long Beach Peninsula tomorrow around 10:16 a.m. and you hear loud sirens, don't panic. Pacific County, along with Clatsop and Tillamook counties, will be participating in the Great Shakeout, an earthquake and tsunami drill. Later today, Pacific County Emergency Management will be sending out a countywide reverse 911 message to test the county's hyper-reach system that's used to spread emergency messages. This message will inform people about the Great Shakeout happening tomorrow. Washington's network of all hazard alert broadcast sirens will then be tested around 10:16 a.m. tomorrow, October 16th. The wailing sound will be followed by a message in English and Spanish notifying that it is only a test, with instructions to test your evacuation route. Pacific County is in a multi-year process to update its comprehensive plan, which is used to manage population and employment growth by focusing on issues like housing, transportation, and capital investments. Legislation recently passed by the Washington State Legislature also requires counties and cities to explore climate-related hazards relevant to their area and to prioritize strategies to address the effects of those hazards. As part of its public outreach, Pacific County is seeking community input via two online surveys that are active through this Tuesday, October 20th. And both the cities of Long Beach and Ilwaco will be holding open houses later this month for public feedback. The Long Beach open house will be held Tuesday, October 27th at 4 p.m. at City Hall. Ilwaco's open house will be held the following day, Wednesday, October 28th, at 6 p.m. in the Ilwaco Community Building. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. You're listening to KMUN News.
If there's one thing that residents of the Grays River Valley in Wakayakum County, Washington can count on, it's that the Grays River will flood and flood again. Most years, these floods are minor and short-lived, but sometimes heavy rains and high winds result in catastrophic deluges that whisk away structures and turn the valley into a bathtub for days on end. At one point, a fire station was forced to move to higher ground permanently because of persistent flooding. Recently, one woman had to be airlifted off the roof of her car by the Coast Guard. Last year, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers seemed poised to study the Grays River flooding, as they have before. Now that effort is stalled. For the community, the question remains, how do you coexist with a river that routinely bursts its banks? Riley Yuan reports.
That's the sound of muck in one of the many tiny channels that drain fields of the old Candle Farm in Rossburg, Washington, a few miles upstream from where the Grays River meets the Columbia River. The Candles, like many other pioneer families that settled the area, built a dike around their farm in the early 20th century, which kept the tides at bay and allowed them to keep cows on the fields. 20 years ago, the Columbia Land Trust, a Vancouver-based nonprofit, acquired roughly 160 acres of this farmland at the end of Candle Road. The trust breached the Candle family's dike in 2005 in an effort to reconnect the floodplain and turn those tiny channels into functional salmon habitat. Months later, a severe flood swamped the farm and scoured neighboring properties to the north. The trust acknowledged certain mistakes and has since re-engineered large portions of the site, but the experience still left a sour taste in the mouths of many neighbors and a lingering distrust throughout the community. Now the trust wants to breach the dikes at the end of nearby Rystica Road, and the neighbors there are not only concerned about flooding, but also about the compatibility of their vision with that of the trust's. They worry that conservation projects will encroach on their land and on their way of life. Local historian Irene Martin puts this way of thinking very simply.
For a lot of people, water doesn't mean much. Land does. People didn't come out here to homestead water. They came out here to homestead land. And land is where the cash value is, not the water. So they're not going to value a swamp for exactly that reason, because they value land. And a swamp, to them, is wasted space that could be filled in and made, in their view, productive.
But as studies have already shown, a bigger issue than the presence or absence of dikes has been driving the severity of floods. Between 2004 and 2007, staff at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Columbia River Estuary Task Force teamed up to perform a comprehensive watershed and biological assessment of the Grays River, with funding from the Bonneville Power Administration. The study quantified what many locals have observed with their own eyes, namely, that huge amounts of sediment have been coming down out of the hills for decades as a result of intensive logging and road building. Researchers estimated that current rates of erosion in the watershed are far greater than what would typically be expected in forested watersheds of the coast. Erosion can directly destroy salmon spawning grounds or lead to a buildup of sediment that smothers nests and makes channels increasingly shallow and hot. But this can be hard for the average person to see. If you want to see the effects of erosion and flooding with your own eyes, you have to head to the lowlands. Gary Burkhalter's family has been dairy farming in Rossburg for generations. The Grays River has always flooded their fields in the wintertime. But within the past decade or two, the river has also started to carry away huge chunks of the riverbank, leaving behind crumbling edges and sheer drop-offs. Trees that have stood for decades are toppling into the river. Rows of piling that once marked the river's edges are now situated squarely in the middle of the channel. The river's behavior, as Gary and his son Austin say, is getting increasingly unpredictable.
I think it's a little more flashy, the river, meaning that...
Comes up quick.
Yeah, yeah.
Faster.
It's coming down fast. I mean, it's kind of like a wave coming down, you know. I think it's a little faster. I think it's... You don't need as big of a weather event to make it come out of the banks anymore.
The reason for this is simple. As the channel gets shallower, floodwaters more quickly overtop the riverbank and spread out on either side. This sudden flooding and movement of the river's channel are the sign of a river trying to find its elbow room. Some residents are trying to slow the erosion on their own properties through stream bank stabilization and rehabilitation projects. They might recontour and revegetate the slope of the bank and insert large woody debris into the channel that can interrupt the flow of water and trap sediment. These structures also double as habitat, offering migrating fish a place to hide and rest. Where rehabilitation really matters, though, is in the Willapa Hills. Last year, the Cowlitz tribe purchased thousands of trees from Rayonier, the timber company that owns much of the Upper Grays River watershed. Working with an engineering firm, the tribe created log jams out of the trees and inserted them into the river channels at various strategic locations, with the intention of trapping sediment. Pete Barber is the restoration ecologist for the Cowlitz tribe.
So our design is looking at really just trying to increase the quantity of wood in a lot of the channels, and looking at, by doing that, it slows the water that's moving through that system, and it can back up and get into the floodplains where it drops out some of the fine sediment, and it also creates habitat that's necessary for fish, and it also allows the river to start banging around.
Still, it remains to be seen how much these efforts are able to slow down the movement of sediment without simultaneous large-scale changes in logging practices. In a statement, a harvest manager with Rayonier explained that since 2001, the company has taken steps to increase road maintenance and even road abandonment to minimize erosion. But the effects of logging on a river can lag behind the actual timber harvests by decades. In other words, we're just starting to feel the effects of things that happened in the past, and it will take just as long into the future to feel the effects of any changes the Grays River communities make now. I'm Riley Yuan, reporting.
Riley Yuan reports for the Chinook Observer as a Murrow Fellow and has partnered with KMUN on a variety of local journalism projects.
This is KMUN. I'm Sylvia Thorpe. An estimated 400,000 Washington State residents could lose their health coverage if federal policy changes hold. Reporter Eilish O'Neill has more.
About one in every 25 Washington State residents is expected to lose their health insurance. Emily Bryce is co-executive director of Northwest Health Law Advocates.
A lot of people are going to be hurting.
Some of them have been buying health insurance on the state marketplace. But when federal subsidies expire next year, their premiums will skyrocket, and about 80,000 people won't be able to afford them anymore. On top of that, 300,000 Washingtonians are expected to lose their Medicaid coverage in about a year. Many immigrants who are here legally, like refugees, won't be eligible, and citizens will have to prove twice a year that they work at least 80 hours a month. States with similar requirements have found that a lot of people who do work lose their coverage anyway, either because they don't know about the requirement or they can't keep up with the paperwork.
As pear harvest wraps up, many farmers in Washington are feeling a market shift after a major pear cannery in Yakima closed. NWPB's Renee Diaz talks to pear growers about how the closure impacts their harvest.
Every year, Edgar Hernandez grows about 500 bins of pears and ships them to the Del Monte Pear Cannery in Yakima. This year, he left his pears on the trees because the cannery closed this summer.
We didn't harvest anything, so pretty much 100% loss.
John Devaney is with the Washington State Tree Fruit Association. He says many growers were blindsided by the move.
Growers, they had to then struggle to find alternate customers. If you were a pear grower growing for the canning market, it created a lot of dislocation.
Devaney says there's been less demand for canned pears after the pandemic. I'm Renee Diaz reporting.
Nearly 92,000 sockeye salmon returned to the Baker River system this year. That's a historic milestone for nearby tribes, state wildlife officials, and the hydroelectric utility that caused the decline and helped bring the fish back. KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe has the story.
Scott Schuyler is the Upper Skagit Tribe's policy representative for cultural natural resources. He says the tribe once had a fishing village called Sabalacu.
Right on Natural Baker Lake. And that's where people lived and died and fished and hunted since time immemorial.
Two huge hydroelectric dams put an end to the village. They were built without fish passage. By the mid-1980s, the sockeye returns dropped to fewer than 100. Schuyler took part in the negotiations 20 years ago to relicense the dams under federal law. Now special tanker trucks move fish from a new hatchery past the dams. This was built and paid for by Puget Sound Energy. Skyler says his tribe had one goal: to save this run of sockeye.
From a cultural standpoint, I can't explain enough what it means to have our tribal members fish in their ancestral river at an ancestral village location. They're touching their history, their culture, their past while we're fishing there.
2 years ago, 63,000 sockeye returned to the Baker River system. So Skyler says getting to nearly 92,000 this year is a big deal. He says several other salmon runs in the Skagit watershed, including Chinook, still need help. But for now, his tribe is celebrating this win. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
Washington is the top apple-producing state in the nation, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But as NWPB's Renee Diaz reports, wildfire smoke could affect the harvest in one of the state's largest apple-growing regions.
Wildfires during this fall's apple harvest filled the Wenatchee Valley with thick smoke. That means growers are dealing with a lack of sunlight. Less sunlight changes how the apples look.
Some of the challenges right now is getting color. With the smoke not letting able the sun to shine down, well, it kind of hinders that productivity of getting the color pigments in the flesh of the apple to kind of come out.
That's Francisco Sarimiento Torres. He's an instructor in the Wenatchee Valley College's Agriculture Department. Apples like Honeycrisp need to be exposed to the sun to achieve a rich red and yellow color. For now, Torres says growers are hoping for clear skies as the last apples come off the trees. I'm Renee Diaz reporting.
You're listening to news from KMUN. To contact the KMUN News Department, email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org.